This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we're joined by AOPA's Tom Haynes. He's Senior VP of Media Outreach and Communications. We talk about aviation advocacy accomplishments in 2018 and look ahead to 2019, the regional fly-ins, the You Can Fly program, next year's Arsenal of Democracy flyover, and a lot more. In the news, we consider 7 airline innovations, the training accident fatality rate, and the ANA dual engine shutdown. Also, Launchpad Merzari on Snarge, plans for an Around Australia charity flight, and someone wants to open Meigs Field Airport for a different kind of aviation. Oh, and we take the first ever Airplane Geeks battery break. It's all coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 536 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. And joining me is first David Vanderhoof, our aviation historian. Hi, David.
Hi, everyone. We're having a bit of a chill here. Actually, I don't think I've recovered from last night where I was out at, I guess it was 12:30 at night watching the lunar eclipse, which was amazing, but it was like 5 degrees above zero Fahrenheit here. So it's been a chilly day, but I'm looking for some interesting hot topics tonight.
There you go. Also with us is Max Trescott. He's host of Aviation News Talk podcast. He's the 2008 CFI of the year. And of course, he's an expert on learning to fly or purchase a Cirrus aircraft.
Hello, Max and colleagues here. And I'm just sitting here thinking about, should I mention that I was walking on the beach yesterday taking great photographs? Nah, I guess I won't mention that.
We hate you in the East. At least right now we do. All right. Well, our guest this episode is Tom Haynes. Tom is the Senior Vice President of Media, Communications, and Outreach for the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association. Tom also hosts AOPA Live this week with Melissa Rudinger. Tom owns and flies a Beechcraft Bonanza. He soloed that at, well, maybe not that airplane, but he soloed at age 16, earned a private pilot certificate at 17. He's flown more than 100 different models of general aviation airplanes. Tom, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Hey, good afternoon, guys. Good evening. It's great to be with you.
Yeah, you were on the show a long time ago, maybe like 4 or 5 years ago, I think.
At least, yeah.
Well, we're still here. We're still going strong.
I guess so. At 536, you're doing great.
We are. Thank you. Yes, yes. Now, but I have a question for you. You have a Bonanza. What's older, your Bonanza or your AOPA membership?
Well, let's see. My years of ownership of the Bonanza is not as long as my AOPA membership, but the age of the Bonanza is older. It's a 1972. It's a Nixon era airplane. You know what I mean. Yeah, it's pre-Watergate, though.
the good old days.
Oh. Now, there's an age. It's a Nixonian vintage aircraft. Is that good? The EAA's new category down in antiques, Nixonian vintage.
Yeah, yeah.
But his airplane is not a crook. That we know.
That's right.
I don't know. There are days when I'm throwing money at it that it feels like it might be.
All right.
Yeah, well. But you know, hey, one thing. I also have another airplane though. Apparently, I didn't make it onto the bio there. It's I bought an RV-12, an SLSA last summer. It's a 2014. So I've got a 21st century airplane too.
That's fantastic. Yeah, very nice. All right. Well, we'll hear more about that maybe coming up, and as well as some topics concerning AOPA. Now, the membership, are you, I say you guys, I'm a member. Membership is approaching, what, about 400,000, is it?
No, it was, there was a time when it was just north of 400,000, but then like everything else after 2008, it went down pretty dramatically, partly because we stopped marketing so many fringe members and decided to pay attention to the folks who really make a difference instead of trying to just chase the number. And so anyhow, the number has fallen to about 325. But the good news is after, being on a slow decline for the last decade or so, actually ticked up in 2018. So we're actually seeing some actually positive news, not just in AOP membership, but you know, flight ops and airplane deliveries and that sort of thing are not so bad. They're ticking up a little bit. So that's good news.
Yeah, it is good news. Excellent, excellent. All right, well, why don't we get started? Let's jump right in with some of the aviation news from the past week. Are you guys ready?
Ready from the West.
Ready from the Arctic.
Our first story comes from Bloomberg. This is, these airline innovations will change the way you fly. Now, the article points out that many airlines are engaged with, I guess you could call them aviation think tanks these days. Everybody seems to be looking for the next big thing. Examples, Air France and KLM have Big Blank. That's an incubation studio. IAG, which of course is the parent company of BA, Iberia, Vueling, and Aer Lingus, has its accelerator Hangar 51. There's the Lufthansa Innovation Hub, the JetBlue Technology Ventures. And in this article, they list out seven projects that they say are things to watch for in 2019. The first one is facial recognition at the airport, things like virtual passports. And we talked about that pretty thoroughly last episode. An example of that is British Airways at JFK with facial recognition. But there's some other interesting ones. Interlinked services that automatically rebook after disruptions. The idea is that instead of a process having to take place after some disruption, a flight cancellation or delay or something, that the system would automatically do all of that for you. And Lufthansa's looking at something like that. Next one is flight delay prediction, something that JetBlue is working on with their technology ventures. Pay for flights by the hour or in bulk. That's an interesting one. Rather than buying one ticket at a time, JetBlue's Sky Hour and Flight Pass are examples of that. Next one, automated self-driving baggage cars. This is a situation where the self-driving car would bring the baggage to you instead of coming from an airplane, I guess, into a common collection area. These little cars would drive the bags to wherever they needed to be next. Another one is associated with that kind of is real-time baggage tracking. Another one is the final one, something that we keep seeing these days, electric VTOL flying cars. They admit that one is maybe a little farther out in terms of being realized. What do you guys think? Do you think these things are likely to happen? Are these just pie-in-the-sky ideas, wishful thinking? I don't know. Let's start with Max Trescott. What do you think about this list?
Yeah, being out here in Silicon Valley surrounded by constant innovation, yeah, that kind of turns me on. I always like seeing an industry that starts to rethink things and starts to look at how they can make things better. And I hope some of these actually make a difference. I look at the first one and go, Face ID. Does that save me any time getting through with my boarding pass? You know, the whole boarding pass thing is pretty fast now, so I'm not sure that, you know, that really helps a lot. What really I get most excited about would be the automatic rebooking. It was just a year ago I had a flight to Chicago that got diverted to Des Moines, and we were all sitting there, you know, frantically trying to rebook tickets. And you know, you ought to be able to automate, that. So I think that's really a big deal. The one that I know David and I are most interested in, I don't see on the list. I'm still waiting for them to figure out how to innovate to give us more leg room.
Yeah. We'll come back to David, our resident cynic, I think. But Tom, any thoughts on any of these?
I resemble that remark.
Speaking of resembling, you know, facial recognition, I mean, I think that's definitely going to happen. I do agree with Max, Max of the West, though, that I'm not sure how much, at this point, they've gotten the process down pretty well. I'm not sure how much time it would save, except that if you didn't really have to have a boarding pass anymore, you just walked up to the thing and it recognized you and let you not only through security, but then also into the airplane. I suppose maybe that could save a little bit of time, but that seems like pretty likely to happen. The eVTOL thing is, I think, is a ways out there. However, we've just created a series of animations. We haven't even released these yet, so stand by. You'll probably see them starting to show up in the next few weeks. But a series of animations about how VTOLs and what the future might look like in an eVTOL kind of world when you use your local general aviation airport as part of the infrastructure. You know, you see all these animations from Uber and places where they're taking off from rooftops. Well, okay, maybe that will happen at some point in a few locations. But the idea that rooftop after rooftop after rooftop in urban areas is going to be a landing site for these things is pretty unlikely. For one thing, there would be a lot of power if you're trying to recharge off of those the infrastructure already in place in those buildings, and winds and neighbors and a lot of reasons. You know, we saw what happened with Pan Am helicopters in New York years ago when you try to take off on the top of windy office buildings. And anyhow, so we've created this animation that demonstrates the importance of general aviation airports in the future infrastructure for eVTOL, because they may not be the only place that these things take off and land, but it's pretty logical that they be someplace, you know, some of the infrastructure, and certainly for maintenance and charging and overnights and those kind of things. So it's a way for us, we think, to remind the public that you have this great vision of being able to sort of George Jetson your way to work. Let's make sure we're protecting our general aviation airports now, so that they're still here whenever that vision gets here. And Santa Monica, yeah, of course, would be a place that we might happen to be focusing some of these ads on that feature this animation. So we'll see where that goes.
Yeah, that's fascinating. That makes a lot of sense, too. I think you're right, because the top of a building doesn't really have any of the infrastructure or much of it that you'd need. And a local GA airport is perfectly situated to provide those kinds of services. Yeah.
Right. They have parking, automobile parking for the customers. They have power. They've got wide open spaces. You know, so I was talking to somebody just the other day about the amount of air that has to be moved downward in order to support, say, an 800 or 1,000 pound vehicle or 800 pounds of payload, and how much disturbance that would cause wherever it is that you're going. And of course, in airports, we got helicopters and stuff. We got lots of open space that isn't going to be all that disturbed with these big downdrafts as these things are settling down to the ground or taking off.
Yeah, fascinating.
And I much prefer to see that happen at the airport than in my neighborhood. I just imagine what the noise would be like if everybody had one of these in their garage. It would be kind of like if everybody on the airliner was talking on their cell phone. No fun.
Yes, yes.
I'm right. Yeah.
David, any of these resonate with you, either in a positive or negative fashion?
I'm surprised nobody picked the luggage.
Well, that was going to be mine, actually. But
I mean, out of all of these, besides the interlocked surfaces or that rebook after disruptions, the most common thing to fix out of this whole list is the luggage. They lose luggage on good days, let alone bad weather days or whatever. So you can go out and buy a chip right now and put on anything and look it up on your cell phone and find it. You know, even your cell phones have "where are you" detectors on them. I don't know why this is such a stretch that we can't just tag our luggage. And now that I've whined about this, when I go to Hawaii in 3 weeks, I'm sure they're going to end up losing my luggage. The eVTOL cars, you can tune into every Friday because to hear my opinions on that. But I do like the, and I also like the automated baggage cars. I mean, we have a lot of automated, there's been a lot of automated robotics in warehousing. Now I'm going into that other industry that I work in, that have self-driving baggage carts and high-lows, etc. That shouldn't be such a stretch, other than it'll last up until the first self-driving car drives into it and takes out an A380. But I think all of these are good ideas. It's just, do the airlines have the money or the monetary will to implement them, I guess is my question.
Absolutely. If they're able to charge a fee for these new services, they will find the will to do it.
And
Max, I'm disappointed. When we brought Tom and you brought up General Aviation Airport, you did, and all of the things that you can get at General Aviation Airport, you didn't mention restaurants. I'm disappointed.
Oh, that's coming. Yeah, the food. Yeah, I like the baggage technology. I mean, everybody tries to carry as much on board as possible because the checked luggage situation is such a disaster and is so unpleasant. And I always thought that I would much rather check my luggage rather than try to carry it all on board. And there must be a way to make the baggage process fast and efficient. The ultimate would be I walk off the plane and there's my baggage right there. My luggage, my checked luggage. There is no waiting. And there ought to be technology solutions to that. So I like some of these as well.
And so I wasn't real clear on this self-driving cars will handle your bags. Where are they going to take it to? I mean, ideally, I'd like to have it just drive it to my house.
Yeah, that would be good.
Do you have any idea where these self-driving things are supposed to deliver your baggage to?
Yes, I think the idea is to, if you have another flight, a connecting flight, it goes right to the flight, that it doesn't go to a central baggage location where it then gets sorted and then sent on to your next flight. It just goes straight to the flight. If you're departing the airport, then it just goes straight to someplace where you can pick it up on your way out of the airport. I think it's a strategy of separating all the baggage by traveler and then processing it on a per traveler basis, depending on what that traveler is doing next.
And if you have the same smart tag to use that technology, you can give that tracking ability to the owner of the said luggage, and it's a nice wrapped little package. And yes, I'll pay an extra $10 for that. I don't care. I'm going to have to pay for extra legroom, as my co-host out in the West said. But it's all one thing. Okay, Max, close your ears because I'm going to say something that we don't say too often, but it's as bad as blockchain. IoT, Internet of Things.
Yeah.
To be able to track my luggage by my phone, I think is a good thing.
Yes.
And I think my in-laws really had it right years ago. They solved all of these problems. They would go from New York to Florida, and they would just FedEx their luggage ahead of time. And you know what?
Yes, that's a great solution.
It's when you look at baggage fees, it's probably cheaper. And, you know, how often does FedEx lose a box?
So that's right.
That may be the ultimate solution.
That's right. All right. Well, let's move on to another story. This is from General Aviation News. Number of fatal training accidents drops 35%. And this comes from a study by the AOPA Air Safety Institute, as well as Liberty University School of Aeronautics. And Max T., what did they find here?
Oh, I think we should ask Tom. Tom, what did they find?
Well, they found flight training accidents dropped by 35%. There's a chart that accompanies that article, and it's pretty interesting to see the breakdown of the audience, fatal accidents occurred during training back in 2000 is the start of the study and running through 2015. And they're divided up between loss of control, CFIT, mid-air collisions, and then other. And what's interesting when you look at the trend over time of what's happened with them, of course, all of them generally have trended down to the point that we have really not very many training accidents in 2015, which was the last year for the data that they looked at. But what's interesting is that mid-air collisions have disappeared the last couple of years. Doesn't mean that one won't crop back up again, but you wonder about that. And the other one, this category that's down rather significantly, well, both loss of control and CFIT are down as well. And so it's interesting to ponder what might contribute to that. And you wonder whether ADS-B, for example, although in 2015, I don't know how many training airplanes were equipped with ADS-B such that you might avoid mid-air collisions. But I'm sure there were some. Certainly some of the university fleets had it back in 2015. And it'll be interesting to see how that plays out over time, whether we can continue to reduce the number of mid-air collision accidents. And then CFIT, which isn't a huge, never was a huge thing in training, except maybe in instrument training. But when it, particularly primary training wasn't much of a big deal. But if you look at the corporate fleet, of course, the number of CFIT accidents is down dramatically over the last couple of decades as a result of terrain warning systems and EGPWS and other systems that bring much more situational awareness regarding terrain.
Ian, what does CFIT stand for?
Controlled flight into terrain.
Oh, sorry about geez. That. Oh, yeah. I should have been able to figure that out. That's right. That's right.
So the big question is, why do we think this happened? I mean, did flight instructors suddenly, you know, get smarter, or did all the worst flight instructors get hired by the airlines? No, seriously. I mean, why? I'm joking on the last one. I mean, we'd see a rash of airline accidents if that were the case, I suppose. But, you know, I don't have an explanation. I'm just kind of curious.
Yeah. Well, certainly there's been an industry-wide effort on loss of control. And I know our Safety Institute has spent a lot of money and time and effort creating videos and other things, and other training organizations have as well. And so I think that accounts for a significant number of the decreases is just better training around loss of control, and also then informing instructors on better ways to not only teach loss of control prevention, but also how to avoid it in the training environment so that we don't have students with an instructor sitting right there somehow getting out of control in a stall spin accident or something like that.
You know, I did think of one thing that might have contributed in the, at least in the early part of this study. This study goes back to 2000, and it was 2001, where, of course, we had 9/11, and then there was a huge drop in, you know, in flight training and aviation in general. But for sure, they stopped, the airlines stopped hiring flight instructors away. So after 2001, the pool of flight instructors actually started becoming a lot more experienced over the next decade because, you know, those who came into flight training it had many fewer opportunities to go to the airlines than they would have had in the past.
Tom, do you know what the background is for this study, the genesis of it? The Air Safety Institute undertakes a lot of interesting initiatives. Do you know why they looked at this issue?
Well, it was a joint effort with Liberty University School of Aeronautics just to look at what are the opportunities, what's been happening in that market, and what do we need to do to continue to make flight training as safe as possible. And I mean, to be perfectly honest, I'm not sure who started the conversation, but obviously the Air Safety Institute is always focused on training and has looked at the flight training environment in the past in some studies. And my guess is this is a follow-up to some earlier studies that have been done to understand what causes accidents in the training environment and what can we do to train better to prevent those kind of accidents. Mm.
So the Air Safety Institute has a pretty broad perspective of air safety, and so they undertake a number of different types of initiatives, I guess you'd say.
Right, and we've worked with universities before on many different types of studies, so that's not unusual. And Liberty University, of course, has a large flight training program of its own, and also they do a lot of analysis kind of work anyhow.
Very good.
Well, we should mention one thing, which is that flight training has actually always been the safest part of the whole accident picture. The typical fatal accident rate these days is bumping around maybe 1.0 fatals per 100,000 hours, and flight training has always been roughly a third of the overall rate. And sure enough, this is down at 0.3 for the last year. So the good news is, when you've got a flight instructor in the airplane, your odds of having a fatal accident drop tremendously.
Sure, and I'm happy to hear that that's the case.
Oh, me too, since that's what I'm out there doing five, six days a week.
Yeah. All right, one more item, and this came to us from a number of different folks, including one of our listeners, Jonathan. And this is ANA Boeing 787 dual engine shutdown upon landing. And this is actually an article in the boarding area.
Well, Max, you work for an engine manufacturer for many years. Are they supposed to do that?
No, they're not supposed to do that. And it's highly, highly unusual. Typically, when you have a dual engine shutdown, it's because of a fuel problem or something like that, some other system that affects both engines. But what we have here is the Boeing 787 ANA flight from Haneda to Osaka. It touched down, it landed, and then when the thrust reversers were deployed, the pilots noticed that both engines had shut down. Both Trent Rolls-Royce 1000 engines had shut down. Now, the plane rolled to a stop, obviously a rather lengthy roll because it had no thrust reverser going on. No reported injuries or anything. But the question is, and we don't have an answer for this yet, is what would cause this to take place? Most people, I think, are thinking some kind of a software issue.
And we're sure it's not like a new feature that Boeing has incorporated to save fuel.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, and neglected to make a big point of that in the training program associated.
Could that happen?
They've been recently in the news for not talking about special features that they didn't train on.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. So some kind of software. When I first saw this and was asked what I thought about it, the notion of some kind of a software glitch or some other system that caused the software to behave in this way. And there is a possibility. There's something that's called the Thrust Control Malfunction Accommodation System, or the TCMA system. And this is something it's fairly common. In fact, Boeing has a patent for this that was issued in 2002. And the idea is that this system is supposed to prevent problems associated with an uncommanded high thrust situation. So, in other words, if the system detects a high thrust situation that was not commanded, then it takes some action. One thing it can do is to simply reduce the fuel flow. It even has the authority to shut down an engine if it's detecting an overthrust condition. And this can happen anywhere. It can happen on the ground. It can happen in the air. Of course, in this particular case, this was taking place on the ground. So that's the question. Now, Boeing says that errors in the landing sequence could actually cause this system, this TCMA system, to activate. Such as, quote, a combination of selecting full reverse too quickly before the aircraft has transitioned to ground mode, followed by a quick deactivation of reverse thrust. And there's actually a bulletin out there. I looked for that, but I couldn't find it. But reportedly, there's a bulletin out there where Boeing gives the advice not to apply full reverse too quickly. So that may be at the center of this problem, or it could be something else. We don't know. But when you're rolling down the runway and you go to engage the thrust reversers and both engines shut down, it's not a very warm feeling, I think.
No, and this last explanation that you've come up with here, it really bothers me because I often see folks who, this would tend to be lower time folks, hopefully not people with the kind of experience you'd find in the airlines, but they're often a little excited and hyped up at the moment of touchdown and sometimes do things that they wouldn't if they were thinking clearly. So, I worry about a thrust reverser that can be applied too quickly. That's a moment where it would be easy to envision that someone's all primed and ready and, yep, they pull it back quickly, immediately, promptly, at touchdown. And if that could cause a problem, I'd like to think they could find a fix for that, because to me that's a kind of human behavior that, could occur.
Wait a minute. You're not supposed to land like a C-130 and put your pitch props and beta pitch before you hit the ground? That's not the way it's supposed to work? Ooh. Oh, okay. What do I know? Continue.
Well, I did look up this patent that Boeing has, and if you're interested in reading patents, we'll put a link in the show notes. I know it's kind of difficult to read these things sometimes. But one thing I noticed,
it's kind of geeky and something you would do in a heartbeat.
Oh yeah, 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 yeah. one thing I noticed from the patent, and I assume this is what they've implemented in the 787, but in the patent, it's a redundant system. It's got two systems that are independently checking for this condition, and so which would tend to make it, you would think, less likely to be the culprit of this situation. But we'll find out. I guess since this was in Japan, they're not suffering under a partial government shutdown, so they're equivalent of the NTSB, I'm sure, will be all over this. Again, we're speaking with Tom Haines, Senior VP of Media Outreach and Communications at AOPA, aopa.org, of course. And, you know, maybe right up front, Tom, I'll give my my standard pitch when we're talking about AOPA, which is that you don't have to be an aircraft owner or pilot to belong to AOPA. And that's something I learned from Aunt Benet Wilson, many, many years ago, who explained that to me. And so if you're interested in good advocacy for aviation, AOPA is one of the organizations that provides that. Tom, maybe looking back on 2018, were there some kind of major high points or sort of notable advocacy activities from AOPA?
Well, yeah, I mean, the big one that was a real victory for everybody in general aviation and really arguably for the entire U.S. economy and anybody who ever gets on an airliner or gets a package via the airline was the work that we did and others too, NBAA also being a big part of that, National Business Aviation Association, worked with us closely on this and many others, but it was beating back the air traffic control privatization effort that the airlines had mounted and continued, it was, very hot and heavy throughout 2017 and then in continued right into 2018. And, we really managed to bring together some 250 or so aviation organizations and managed to get about 200,000 phone calls and emails and messages sent to members of Congress expressing concern about this and just asking for them to overturn this or keep it from becoming a law. And what happened was in February of 18, Congressman Schuster out of Pennsylvania, who was the one driving this thing for the most part, withdrew the bill after about 18 months of pushing very hard with a lot of backing, a lot of money by the airlines were behind this thing. And, little old general aviation, often fragmented, was able to become united and keep this thing from happening. And he had to withdraw the bill without it ever getting a full House vote because he just could not muster the support. And so that was a big win. However, it didn't really stop him. The president was also in favor of this as part of his infrastructure bill. And he was lamenting about how poor the U.S. air traffic control system is and how its technology is so outdated and all the things that are wrong with it. Mind you, it is the largest, most sophisticated air traffic control system in the world that handles more traffic than anybody else. And I think for most of us on a day-to-day basis, works pretty darn well. But Schuster tried to sneak it back in April, attached to another bill, language that was very similar to that. And we heard about it. Our team in D.C. Happened to catch wind of it, saw the language that was being proposed in a bill, and put the alarm out. And within about 24 hours, we again mustered many tens of thousands of messages to members of Congress saying, cut it out. And that also didn't make it in. So that was a big victory for all of general aviation when we were able to get that thing shut down. And then sort of on top of that in 18, the next part of that is the reauthorization bill that followed in the fall, or late summer, I guess it was, where we finally have a five-year authorization, which means that it's unlikely that we're going to see the privatization surface again, because typically that argument about privatization and user fees and all those kind of things related to air traffic control is in sync with the FAA reauthorization efforts. And the fact that we've got a five-year bill for the first time in since the early 80s means that hopefully this thing is tucked away and not coming back for a few years at least, and we can actually focus on some other things that are far more productive and will allow us to actually modernize the air traffic control system, which we all agree that there are things that can be done, and focus hopefully in partnership with the airlines as opposed to opposing them on ways that we can and bring some real progress to, say, all of aviation.
Yeah. What are some of those things that we look forward to?
Well, some of it is agreeing on the best path for next-gen, the next-gen air traffic control system, and where the money should be focused and which features we should be spending the most time on and prioritizing that so that we can bring efficiencies to the air traffic control system, particularly at a time when the number of airline passengers is growing pretty dramatically, as Boeing forecasts the number of airplanes it plans to sell over the next 20 years, which is also where we're getting the pilot numbers that Boeing says we're needing 206,000 or something commercial pilots in the next 20 years to support the growing air traffic demands, which means more airplanes in the air and limited number of airport or runways that we have right now. And so we need to figure out how to get them in and out of the major airports more efficiently. And so if we come together with the airlines and talk about that, we can do it in a way that helps protect general aviation airports and general aviation access to the airspace while hopefully allowing the airlines to also continue to grow and be financially strong and help the public who needs those that kind of service get what they need too.
Hmm. When people talk about next gen, it seems to frequently the conversation seems to frequently revolve around the 2020 ADS-B mandate.
Right.
But there's more to it than just that, right?
Well, there is. There's a number of other big systems. That's certainly the one that impacts general aviation the most. There's ERAM and RNP approaches, PNB, which is performance-based navigation, or PBN, performance-based navigation, which is generally more for the airlines, and it has to deal with their ability to fly more efficient approach procedures into airports, airline airports, and also things like constant descent, if you hear about that, and those sort of techniques that allow basically that in the future we could see, thanks to ADS-B, air traffic control could line up these airliners, you know, many, many, many miles away from their destinations and get them all sequenced at the right speeds and the right distances so that in an ideal setting, they can all basically power back for their descent and essentially coast into their destinations, saving fuel and all at the proper sequence so that they can land very efficiently and that you don't have somebody coming in from somewhere else kind of out of sync with everybody else and kind of messing up the works. And those are kind of technologies which take a lot of sophisticated processing to get done. That's the kind of places that we could be focusing. And ADS-B, of course, plays a big part in that, that's the surveillance system of the future and how it is that air traffic control keep track of where all of us are and we'll know where other airplanes are. But from a GA standpoint, well, actually from the airline standpoint too, getting everybody equipped with ADS-B out by the end of this year, all of a sudden, you know, we can't say how many more years it is because it is less than a year now. Getting them all equipped is going to be a real challenge because we have I haven't looked at the numbers in a while, but it's something only 50,000-ish general aviation airplanes equipped and a fairly small percentage of the airline fleet of a couple thousand airplanes on the airline side that are actually equipped. So it's going to be challenging. The FAA says it is not going to push that date back. My guess is the airliners will come up with a solution. A few of them have a bit of a they have a bit of a delay that they've been granted, but it's not, they still have to be ADS-B out equipped. It's just that the sophistication of the out signal and the position reporting that they have, have a little bit of a leeway, a couple of years extra to get that done, but they'll still have to be ADS-B out equipped by the end of the year. So anyway, lots of challenges there. We've got the rebate. So that was another sort of legislative win this year, was to get that ADS-B rebate brought back.
Oh, yes.
In 2018. that sort of reduces the sting a little bit. We've also worked a lot with the manufacturers and with the FAA to point out to them that, you know, a few years ago when the cheapest ADS-B out solution was, you know, $5,000, and most of them were more than that, that just wasn't going to fly. When the hull value of a lot of these airplanes is, you know, $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, people are just not going to spend that kind of money. And so, you know, I personally was involved in briefing the administrator on the values of the legacy fleet and the importance of everybody working together to try to come up with lower cost solutions. And we worked with did studies for the avionics manufacturers to point out to them how many GA airplanes there are that are valued with values of less than $40,000. And when they saw those numbers, I think they were all blown away because they didn't realize it was that big. And so they began in earnest a few years ago, really trying to come up with lower cost solutions. And I'll give them credit. The solutions we have available today for about $2,000 for ADS-B out is pretty darn good. And some of them, the UAvionics one, for example,
is
a really cost effective installation as well. So anyway, a lot of progress on that one.
You mentioned the DC office. How many people are there? What do they do, on a routine basis there?
I don't know the number. I think it's around 14 people that we have in our DC office.
Oh, wow.
Some of them are registered lobbyists, and so they're up on the Hill pretty regularly, like daily, working with members of Congress and also the members of the committees that are important to general aviation to educate them about the issues that we face and any legislation that might be brewing that we are opposing or helping to educate them about some legislation that might be pending that we're supportive of that helps general aviation. So that's part of the team. And then we also have in the DC office our airport staff. They manage the airport support network program. We have about 1,700 ASN volunteers around the country. And they're sort of eyes and ears at the local level for us, and that's all coordinated out of the DC office, as well as interacting with the FAA airports staff to make sure that funds are being spent properly on general aviation airports and that infrastructure projects are progressing the way they should be. And then we also have a regulatory team that out of the DC office that works with the FAA on regulatory issues. And they're over there all the time at 800 Independence and trying to make sure they're sitting on all kinds of committees and technical committees and that sort of thing to make sure that general aviation has a voice when regulations are being written such that we can make sure that general aviation is protected. I mean, ACS, which Max Truscott, I'm sure you're familiar with, has been a big one that we've had people on that committee for quite a while on trying to improve the training process and make it more realistic. And that's another example of our regulatory affairs team being involved in that. PAFI, the fuels initiative, we have people sitting on that committee that has been working to figure out how can we find an unleaded fuel for general aviation, not so successful to this point and dragging out further than we all thought it would. But nonetheless, there's been still a lot of work done on that.
So AOPA is interesting in that the organization has a government or regulatory facing side, and that's what we've been talking about. But it also, of course, has a side faces the membership. And I imagine that you must consider the regional fly-ins to be a big, important part of the member-facing function of the organization.
Yeah, absolutely. It's, the regional fly-ins was a change for us starting back in 2014, I guess it was. We moved away from a national three-day show at a convention center in, you know, big cities on the East Coast and the West Coast, and really wanted to be able to go to the members and sort of be in their backyard at smaller locations on an airport, typically free, you know, where in the past, if you went to all the events associated with one of the summits or expos on the coast, it would be a $300 to $400 experience, just the fees to get in and go to the exhibit hall and go to the banquet and all that sort of thing, and as well as your travel to get there. And by moving to a regional approach, we offer them free for the free seminars and free parking and free access to everything. We did start in 2017 running some paid workshops, very intense workshops, and Mr. Truscott has been helping us with some of those, and we appreciate that.
Yeah, and I had a lot of fun on the road with you guys this past year. It was really enjoyable.
Yeah, so those are very popular, and so we've been dialing up things, changing the mix over time of those. We got three fly-ins this year, one coming up in May in Frederick, Maryland, which is our 80th anniversary. This is AOPA's 80th anniversary this year. So actually May 15th is the actual date in 1939 when the incorporation papers were signed. And so on our fly-in on May 10th and 11th is the kickoff, the big kickoff. We're celebrating all year long, but it's the big kickoff event for our birthday celebration. And we also have some really, really cool stuff coming to that May 1 because it's close to when the D-Day squadron, the 20 or so DC-3s and C-47s, are going to be leaving for Europe for the the 75th anniversary of D-Day in Normandy, France. And so some of them are stopping at our place on May 10th and 11th and going to be visiting us. And we're going to have some World War II reenactors there. They're going to do parachute jumps and maybe even some flights down over D.C., which normally, of course, you can't get in a general aviation airplane. But we're trying to set that up. We might be able to do some tours down over that. And we're going to have STOL competitions at all three of our fly-ins this year. They've been very popular, short takeoff and landing contests. And in fact, we're producing an invitational, an AOPA STOL invitational this year, which we've never done before. So that should be fun. But the second one is in June 21st and 22nd in Livermore, California. And then the third one is in the fall, in September 13th and 14th, going back to Tullahoma, Tennessee, where we were there a few years ago, had a great experience, super nice folks down there, great airports. The Beach Heritage Museum is on that airport. And you know, it's a great venue, really good camping. We have camping at these events, and the camping at Tullahoma is really nice. They've got great facilities there.
Tom, I have to mention that I'm so disappointed. Last year, there was a regional fly-in in Connecticut.
Yes, there was, in Groton.
In Groton.
Yeah, that was actually in 17.
Just a hop, skip, and a jump away from me, but I was traveling and couldn't go. So when I found out that Frederick, Maryland was on the schedule for this year, I got really, really excited because, as David knows, I get down to Maryland quite frequently. It's not that far, except I'm going to be in Seattle those dates. So
bummer.
I'm going to miss it again. So
that's a shame.
I think I might take a drive down 15 to
you should.
For that weekend.
Yeah, come on down, dude.
You should. I have driven to Tennessee before.
Well, it is called a fly-in.
Well, yeah, I know.
You know, this is a perfect dovetail for my question for Tom. Tom, my quadcopter won't get me to Tennessee. Yeah. both Max and I are also AOPA members, but tell us a little bit more about that other organization that you guys have started to bring into us dronies who are aircraft operators now, and you guys have been kind enough to bring us into the fold.
Yeah, we really looked at what was happening in the drone space and recognized we had two choices, really. One was we could bury our heads in the sand and pretend it's not happening and hope for the best. That didn't seem like the best thing to do for general aviation. And so we decided instead to embrace that community and provide a lot of educational materials and try to partner with some others there to once again make sure that general aviation is well represented there and that we do a good job of educating drone operators about airspace and about airports and where they are and where you shouldn't be flying your drone, certainly without permission. And so we do have a drone membership. We have a drone email newsletter that's doing very well. It comes out every 2 weeks, and it's got loads of information in it about how to operate safely and also some good feature stories about how people are using drones, particularly from a commercial standpoint and some of the neat things that they're happening in rescues and in work regarding drones. So, yeah, I hope you'll take advantage of that because it's a pretty good program.
It is. That newsletter is fantastic. And, of course, there's a sort of a special membership level for, mm-hmm. For drone operators.
Right. We have some legal services plans available for them. And
yes.
And the neat thing is, you know, we've become drone operators ourselves, in that our photographers use drones a lot. If you look at our video and our photography in the magazines, you'll see there's a lot of angles in there that, guess what, came from drones. And so we're actually, you know, a part of that community as well.
So in terms of communication, yeah, you mentioned the magazine. That's a monthly magazine that is just amazing. I mean, completely professionally done.
Thank you.
There's the AOPA Live This Week program that you and Melissa do. And that's also really incredibly professionally done. Very nice job. For those of you, even if you're not an AOPA member, you can subscribe to it. It's a video podcast, or you can consider it as a video podcast, and you can subscribe to it just like you subscribe to this show, and it's definitely worth watching. And probably if you watch enough of them, you may be interested in becoming a member if you're not already.
Yeah, we've got that Plus Flight Training magazine as our second monthly magazine, and the one that's the only magazine out there for flight instructors and student pilots. And really, we think, does a nice job of bringing forward training information on a consistent basis and helping instructors get better at engaging with students. You know, that's a really big initiative for us at AOPA. And one of our You Can Fly programs, You Can Fly is a sort of multifaceted program that we have to address basically the pilot population. We've got a high school curriculum trying to get high school students aware of the opportunities around aviation. It's all STEM-based, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics curriculum. We've got a flying club initiative where we're teaching people about the benefits of flying clubs and starting flying clubs. In fact, we've started about 101 flying clubs since we began that program, and got a bunch of others who are part of our network. And then another one is Rusty Pilots, which you probably heard of, where we've gotten about 7,000 people back into flying. We've had tens of thousands of people take the course, but about 7,000 we followed closely, and they've actually gone on to finish that ground school and then take the flight portion and get back and get current again and start flying. Some of them have bought airplanes. It's some pretty cool stories out there of how this has impacted people and gotten them back into aviation. But the final part of it is flight schools. And so Flight Training Magazine is an integral part of this effort where we're working with flight schools to help them get better at keeping the students that they get. We have about an 80% dropout rate across the board.
Yeah.
Of students dropping out once they get started in aviation and not completing. And so our goal with the You Can Fly program is to help flight schools and flight instructors get better. And we're beginning to offer courses for customer service, for marketing and promotion. We have a flight school business newsletter that comes out every 2 weeks that's got some tips in it, but we're really ramping up. We're going to be having in-person and virtual classes for flight schools on how to be better at marketers, how to do better promotion. We're also building some training programs for primary students that'll be interactive and adaptive learning, we're calling it, that will adapt to the pace of the student's progress. All be online, and so that's underway too. That's not out yet, and probably won't be until 2020, but it's in development right now. But anyhow, so that flight training thing, we got to fix that, because we're really struggling from a pilot population standpoint, and the flight training system needs to be improved.
And on the You Can Fly program, we mentioned last episode the challenge, the Ray Foundation matching challenge, up to $2 million in matching funds, right?
Yeah, that's remarkable what the Ray Foundation has done for us. They are very generous folks. James Ray was an incredible person, passed away in 2017. But has this foundation that he's left behind. He'd been a donor to AOPA for quite some time. And in the last few years, his foundation has been giving us grant or challenges. And this year, we just announced, as you said, was a $2 million challenge. If we raise $2 million for the You Can Fly programs this year, they'll match it for a total of $4 million, which is incredible and really important, particularly as we're developing that high school curriculum, because that's very expensive. We've got the ninth grade one done, and several thousands, more than 2,000 students using it this year. 10th one is in 10th grade is almost done. It's being beta tested this year. 11th grade is just starting to be developed. And then 12th grade will get started here pretty quickly as well. So that today's 9th graders, by the time they get through their 9th grade, the 10th grade curriculum will be ready for them, and then 11th and then 12th. So they can go through all 4 years of high school using this aviation STEM program from AOPA, but made possible by donors in, you know, period, but the Ray Foundation in particular.
Yeah, that's just amazing. That's so great. Yeah, I am definitely going to make a donation to that.
Thank you.
One last thing, maybe one last thing, that is kind of a little bit far off, but in 2020, we have this Arsenal of Democracy flyover, another iteration of that. And can you tell us a little bit about how AOPA is involved in that?
Sure. Yeah, there was a press event down in D.C., I guess it was last week, maybe the week before. I think it was the week before. But anyhow, it had to be moved. It was originally supposed to be at the National Air and Space Museum, and it was going to be held in the World War II display at the Air and Space Museum, which was the last day that display was going to be open before it got torn down, because they are systematically replacing all of the exhibits in the Air and Space Museum at the mall. And that we were, you know, strategically being having this thing on the last day that it was open, and then the government shutdown came. So guess what? So we had to find another place, and we went to the National Press Club and had the event over there. But it's going to be really, really something. You may recall in 2015, there was another flyover, and I think that was maybe 40-ish airplanes, something like that. World War II era airplanes flying down over Washington, D.C., down right over the mall and right past all the monuments, and then making a right turn and heading out of the area. And it was an incredible sight. And so now they want to do it again in 2020 for the anniversary of VE Day. And so it's being planned now. It's a really big deal. They've already got upwards of 100 airplanes signed up to participate this time. And so it's going to be quite a logistics feat to get security clearances and approvals for all of this to happen in the D.C. airspace, which is the most restricted airspace in the nation. But Mike Ginter, who is our vice president of airports, works out of that D.C. office we were just talking about. He is a really crazy warbird nut, has owned a bunch of airplanes over the years and flies a bunch of warbirds. And he was involved with the planning of the last Arsenal of Democracy flight. And so he's now on the executive committee of the one for 2020, and he is the person responsible for all of that logistics planning regarding airspace access and security. And so that's AOPA's primary connection is through Mike Ginter, but we're also supporting it editorially, of course. And I know that I'm planning to be down there volunteering either at Leesburg or Culpeper, Virginia, which is the two airports from where the airplanes are going to take off from, or downtown. At National Airport, helping out in the tower, or if nothing else, just along the street watching this whole thing happen, because it's going to be way cool.
This is May 9th, right? 2020.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to be there. David, you should be there too.
Well, I definitely will be there, because the last time I watched it was 8 days after I had major surgery. So 5 years late, 5 years later, I'm not going to watch it from my living room on the computer. I'm going to be I'm going to be down there involved with it.
All right. Very good. Well, Tom, thanks so much for taking some time to talk with us and our listeners on your day off, as it turns out, I guess. We really appreciate it.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. There's so much, so many good things that AOPA does. I think AOPA articles feature fairly prominently in a lot of our news segments, because it's just great stuff. So we want to thank you again. I'll repeat what I kind of started with, which was to you listening. If you love aviation, and I have to assume that if you're listening to us, you do, please consider supporting AOPA with membership. There's other organizations too, of course, the EAA and others. And I think a lot of you do belong to one or more of those organizations. But if you don't, I really would encourage people to pick one anyway and you know, offer some support through your membership. So again, Tom, thank you. Is there anything else that I know we covered a lot of territory? Anything else that you want to try to communicate to our audience?
You've written really on all the big stuff. There is just a lot going on, not only with our organizations, but in all of general aviation. A lot of issues out there, things we need to be paying attention to. But as I said earlier, things are actually, you know, feeling kind of positive. We've got a lot of good momentum going on around avionics. You're going to see some really big avionics announcements in the next couple of months that are going to continue to drive down the cost of really sophisticated avionics for our legacy airplanes. We've got some good things happening with engines and electric propulsion. I was just meeting with some folks about some electric propulsion stuff in California a couple of days ago, but on Friday. And there's some interesting things there that I think can have a dramatic impact on the cost of flight training. So lots of good stuff. We always like to focus on the negative, I think, too much, and the challenges of the pilot population and costs and all that thing, all important and things that we gotta pay attention to. But there's some good stuff going on, and it's fun to think about that too.
Yeah.
Well, these are exciting times. You think back to the 1980s and the 1990s, and general aviation seemed to move almost on a glacial time scale. There was just very little change, and last dozen years, things have really been accelerating. It's a very exciting time.
Yeah. Yep. Lots going on, and also regulatory standpoint changes coming to the LSA, the light sport category, the light sport category of aircraft, and I think it's going to become much more flexible. And for a lot of people, that's important. Basic med, we didn't really touch on that, but that's another important way to keep people flying and reduce the cost for particularly those who have special issuances and for whom the FAA is making their life unbelievably complicated when it really doesn't need to be that complicated. And so, again, another good thing for general aviation.
All right. Excellent. Thanks again, Tom.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me on board. I really enjoyed it.
Right, we had a last-minute submission, and I do mean last-minute, from Launchpad Marzari. You might remember that we had a suspected drone strike that we talked about. Well, this got Launchpad Marzari to thinking, and here he is.
Thanks, Max. Up in the sky, it's a bird, it's a plane. Wait, they're coming together. Schwack! Now it's Snarge. Yes, listeners. That blood and feather and goo that's left on an airplane after a bird strike, there's a word for that. It's called snarge. Why do we have a word for that? Because you just don't wipe it away. The FAA wants you to gather it up, put it in a baggie, and mail it to the Smithsonian Institute's Feather Identification Laboratory. And you thought you got yucky stuff in the mail. They will identify what kind of bird it was. This comes back to be useful for figuring out migratory patterns and what can be done, and helps the FAA identify and lessen bird strikes. So snarge is the word for the remnants of a bird strike. Here's my question to Max and Dave and our crossover community with the UAV podcast. What's the word for the remnants of a drone strike? Lastard, Vult, Black, Model Flugzeug Scheitzitz, and the remnants of your drone strike. Where would the FAA have us send that for identification? Popular Mechanics for their drone identification lab? These are things I think about. This is your reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari, frequency change approved. Good day.
Oh, Launchpad. Interesting. Interesting thought. We need a good name for the residue from a drone strike, I guess.
It's been a while since I've heard the word snarge used correctly in a sentence.
Yeah, that's true. That is the word.
We need to figure out what episodes we had the Smithsonian Bird Strike Facility on. Two of the years we were down at Pilot Day.
Right, at the Smithsonian.
So, Launchpad, you can go back and listen. I'm sure that there'll be more of it. I believe the term probably would be shrapnel.
Shrapnel. For a drone strike. Yeah, that seems...
For a drone strike, Max Trescott, what do you call another aircraft leaving parts of their aircraft on yours? Is there a term for that?
Yeah, they call that swapping paint, I think. I mean, that would be if they, you know, if the bump is gentle.
Yeah. All right. Well, but, you know, maybe some of you have some clever suggestions.
Launchpad at
airplanegeeks.com.
Maybe it would be drone detritus or something like that.
Yeah, something like that.
I like that.
All right. We wanted to mention a couple of things. One, you remember Cameron, our teenage listener from Australia. You all have heard him before in a previous episode. Well, he writes and he says, I will be flying around, and he means around, Australia in March of 2019 to raise money for Angel Flight and to promote the aviation industry to kids my age. He says, on my trip, I will be stopping at schools to hold a fundraiser and talk about the aviation industry. The trip is being planned to take 30 days and to visit 25 schools. Cameron says he will cover 7,500 nautical miles of distance and around 75 hours of flying. Now, he's looking for donations to help support his trip. Really a fantastic thing. This is, I think, is he had a birthday. I think he's 16 now, if I remember correctly. But there's a Facebook page. We'll have a link to that in the show notes. Also, a website. And he has a GoFundMe page. And you can find that link on our webpage in the show notes as well. So consider supporting Solomon on his adventure circumnavigating Australia. Pretty cool.
And I should mention a friend of mine did that probably over a dozen years ago, Monica Petrillo. She works in the film industry down in Southern California. And she put together a DVD of the entire 30. It was, in fact, for her, it was 30-day trip flying around all of Australia and shot lots of video. So I'll just go ahead and give a quick shout out. That's called Flyabout, all one word. And you can find it on Amazon Prime and stream it there, or you can buy the DVD off of Amazon. So for anybody who wants to see what it's like flying all the way around Australia, pretty good video.
Yeah, I'll have to look for that. That's cool. Yeah, we seem to have some interesting things going on with some really young people in aviation these days. In fact, our plan is for next episode, one of the segments we're going to have is we're going to bring you a 10-year-old who is quite an aviation enthusiast, a simmer. And he actually just yesterday, as we record this, had an opportunity to visit a full motion flight simulator at United. And he was out there flying aircraft. So look for that next week. All right. Some listener mail. This came in from Jonathan. And, you know, I mentioned to you guys before we started recording that I'd spoken with Rob Mark today, and I forgot to bring this up with him. There's an article in the Chicago Sun-Times where they are apparently interviewing candidates for mayor. And one of them is Willie L. Wilson, mayoral candidate, Mr. Wilson. And he covers a lot of different things in that article, a lot of different questions in that interview. And one of them, though, is that he's proposing to reopen Meigs Field Airport. And you'll recall that this was the airport, I guess, is it on an island? I guess it's sort of on an island, right? But adjacent to...
It's on an island in the lake.
That's right, right next to Chicago.
Yes.
And back in the old days, when Daley was mayor, Richard M. Daley was mayor, he had the runway bulldozed, which ended that that facility without the 30-day notice required by the FAA, and there was a lot of stuff that went on with that. But the proposal here from this mayoral candidate is to reopen the airfield, and we talked about eVTOLs or all of these personal transportation devices or commuter vertical takeoff and land quadcopters, these things. And he's proposing that they reopen that Meigs Field as a location for these things to land. Now, we were talking before about, you know, at general aviation airports as opposed to rooftops of buildings. What Wilson is thinking here is that there's a lot of transportation, you know, in and out of the Chicago area, and this would be an ideal location to, you know, to have a base of operations, I guess, for that kind of activity. So we've got a link to this article. That's a really interesting thought, and I wish we had Rob to sort of comment on that.
I don't think they could recover that field. I don't know. Max T, do you think they could actually recover that field?
I think they could. Yeah, it's the first time I've ever heard the idea, but I think it's a good one. That was closed in 2003, and it never even occurred to me that it might ever reopen. But yeah, I think he's absolutely right. If the you know, the self-steering, you know, Uber-type flying vehicles become common, you're going to need places like this, and I think it makes a whole lot of sense. So all I can say is, anybody who's in the Chicago area, vote for Willie Wilson, and don't just vote once. I would vote, you know, as many times as you can.
Chicago, vote early, vote often.
Exactly.
That's right, the Chicago. Yeah, so that's pretty interesting. Yeah, and I don't know that they'd rebuild it. I think they would build a new facility. I mean, I don't know what it looks like. It's just grass or something, isn't it? I don't think there's anything really there. But yeah, it would.
They tore up the runway and they built a park on the island. They planted trees and stuff. They repurposed it to being a park.
Ah,
it's largely open area now, but it's mostly grass, so it doesn't look like they built any new buildings or facilities on it. So yeah, I think it would be relatively straightforward to turn it back into an airport again.
Yeah. Now, there's maybe a financial motivation there because Willie Wilson notes that when it was operated as an airport, that it contributed between $300 million and $500 million income per year. But as a park, it's contributing $55,000. So, you know, there may be some financial incentive to take a look at this approach. Not that it would necessarily generate the amount that it did in the past, but certainly more than $55,000. All right, we heard from John. Max T, do you want to kind of run us through this? This is a short story John related to about one of his recent experiences flying.
I can do that, but you're going to have to give me probably 2 minutes. The batteries died in my mouse, and I can't scroll the story up, and I can't mute myself. So you want to give me 2 minutes? I'll get some new batteries, and I'll
you're
be up,
going
back
for
up and
batteries.
Around. I was going to do this earlier, and I realize now that I forgot to do it. I got distracted, and I forgot to do it. So it has gone dead. So
all right. Yeah,
hang on. I'll be right back.
Battery break.
Yep.
David, that's got to be a first.
I was just about to say that. That's a first.
So you got anything exciting going on aviation-wise with you? I'm so disappointed that the FAA symposium in Baltimore is postponed.
Yeah, I am too. I'm getting ready, planning my trip to Hawaii. I did reach out to the Air and Space Museum there on Oahu. So hopefully I'll hear from them and we'll schedule some interviews. And again, I will be in Hawaii the week of on the Big Island for most of it, from the 13th to the 21st. I'm looking forward to flying, and I'll have some breaking news for folks. I already have my seat assigned.
Yeah.
And it's not a window seat.
What? On purpose?
On purpose.
Ooh, that's interesting.
My logic being is the length of the flights.
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to need to get up and move, considering I'm in cattle class.
Yeah.
And I figured inconvenience are whoever's sitting next to me. I am when I fly from Hawaii to Oahu, I will have a window seat. So flying into Hickam Field and seeing the F-15s and the B-2s that are there currently, I will get to see. But the the long haul, I decided to take the aisle seat because I need the leg room and I need to move.
That makes a lot of sense to me. That's what I would do as well.
I don't want to.
No, you hate to forego the window.
It goes against every bone in my body, considering most people consider the window is the Vanderhoof in-flight entertainment system.
That's right.
But I think for personal reasons and physical reasons, given my disabilities, I needed to bite the bullet and take an aisle seat. Luckily, it's not an aisle seat or not middle seat or the window seat, because a 5-hour flight and then a 6-hour flight, it's going to be a little rough.
Now, the F-15s and the B-2s, those are temporarily in Hawaii?
Well, no, actually, the Hawaii, there's an F-15 squadron based at Hickam Field, which is actually the airport for Oahu, the civilian airport, and they currently deployed for Pacific operations, 3 B-2s. I posted a couple of pictures on our Slack team last week. They did a flyover of Waikiki Beach and my hotel behind a B-2 and two F-22s. I'm sorry, not F-15s, F-22s.
Oh, that's right. That's what because I saw the photos. Yeah.
The B-2 and the F-22s that are based at Hawaii did a photo op, and my hotel is directly behind the B-2. So I'm hoping they recreate the flight when I'm on the island that week, but I'm really there to see the wildlife, the turtles, the whales. I'm going on my first whale watch ever.
Nice.
So I'm going to be doing other things besides looking at airplanes. But if an F-22 comes flying by, yeah, I'm genetically disposed to look up.
Oh, yeah. And from the pictures, it looked like that was not a particularly high altitude flyby.
No, that was a photo shoot. They were down under 1,000 feet. So,
oh, man.
You know, so you can imagine three F-22s or another aircraft photo shooting down on the two F-22s and the B-2. So they're trying to project power, and so that besides Guam, Hawaii is Hickam Field is one of the operational bases for the B-2s from Whiteman.
Oh, yeah, I didn't know that. Mr. Trescott,
is he back?
It's working. Oh my gosh, I couldn't believe. You know, I got the batteries in. It was still like another 2 minutes before I could get it connect. It's Bluetooth. It's just such a pain.
Max and I decided that that's the first time we've ever had someone run out of batteries in the middle of a show. So
yeah,
we could check that one off after 10 years of production.
Yeah. So I mean, they last a couple of months, and I'm always having to change them. But it's like, ugh, never in the middle of a podcast before. So live and learn. So, well, let's head to the checklist. Batteries refreshed?
Yeah, new item to add.
Exactly.
You know, that checklist gets longer every year.
It does. Yeah. And I got to do it, last week, I think? Something like that.
Yes,
so
you did.
Oh, right. Because I wasn't there. I was wondering, do you guys, so you actually do have an alternative failback procedure when I'm not here to do the checklist? Because that's what I've decided the only reason you guys keep me around.
Well, for the check.
We do have a backup, and I had to ask Max, and I said, what does it mean when David says, hand on the buzzer? What does that mean? Which I noticed you didn't say today, so.
I haven't said that in a while.
Yeah, well, what can I say? Long-term memory.
All right, so you want to take your way reading?
Sure, I'll go ahead and read this email here from John. He says, short story that maybe some of your less experienced listeners will find interesting. Now, he didn't say less experienced at what, but I'm guessing he means flying IFR. He said, I planned a trip from New Mexico to the Chicago area in early March. Required a fuel stop and a Super Viking. That, by the way, is an aircraft that was built in the 60s and maybe early 70s, about 1,200 of them. Built pretty fast aircraft with about 300 horsepower. And as I recall, the wings have wooden spars in them. So it's kind of interesting. And there's, I think the fuselage is fabric covered, but it's always been known as a pretty fast airplane. Let's see. He said it was pretty much a direct flight to the suburbs, going to Bolingbrook International, which I'm not familiar with, but apparently it's near Chicago, 3,400-foot runway. He said it's 6.5 to 7.5 hours flying time depending on winds. True airspeed about 160 knots, which sounds about right for a Super Viking. So the last 1.5 hours were night flying with a 6,000-foot overcast in the Chicago area on an IFR flight plan assigned 7,000 feet. Outside air temperature, high 20s. And that's kind of where my Max's spidey sense would kind of awake and go, whoa, this sounds like a possibility for ice. Anytime you're in the clouds and you know, temperatures are anywhere close to 32, you've got to be thinking ice. He said my lady friend passenger had not experienced night flying weather. He doesn't mention, by the way, if she has decided that she's never going to fly again or not. He says, when we entered the clouds, the strobes were quite dramatic to someone who had not been there before. It really got her attention. That was kind of fun for me. Yeah, so when you go into a cloud and your strobes are on, suddenly it starts flashing bright white in the cockpit because all that light that you pretty much don't see out of the wingtips gets all reflected back into the cockpit.
Yeah, I imagine it must be awfully bright.
Yeah, and most people will turn their strobes off once they go in the clouds because it's really, really distracting.
Ah, okay.
He says, using my flashlight, I could see the ice forming on the wings, called Chicago approach for lower altitude. He cleared me to 5,000, which was below the clouds and the icing, which is a good thing. He said, the single runway is in the middle of a populated subdivision with lots of lights. By the way, that's really challenging at night, trying to pick out an airport that's in the middle of a lot of lights. He says, the runway is always hard to locate at night. Even though I was now in the clear, I ask approach to clear me for a GPS 3-6 instrument approach. Now, that would certainly help because that would take you right to the runway.
So what's the 3-6 part of that? Is that the runway?
That's the runway number. Yeah, exactly. Oh, okay. So this would be leading to a runway that is aligned with due north, short for 360.
Oh. He said it. Oh.
Yeah.
That's due north.
Just like the runway numbers. So runway 3-6, you take the 360, you drop the 0, and that becomes your runway number.
Why do you drop the 0?
Well, because otherwise runways would be things like 3 digits long, and pilots can only handle 2 digits. So
okay.
Yeah, runway numbers go from 1 through 36, and that's it. Otherwise, they'd go from 0 through 360. And that would just make things more complex. And, frankly, knowing the heading of a runway within, anything less than 10 degrees is, just not really necessary. Most people can, line up and land, even if they're 10 degrees off. So it's not, it doesn't have to be that precise.
I honestly never noticed that the runway numbers were only 2 digits. Although now that I think about it, yeah. All right. Okay. Makes sense.
We have got to get you going on those flying lessons.
I know. All right.
Let's see. So the controller declined the instrument approach, said that he would help the pilot find the runway.
So why would he do that?
That's the part that kind of has me wondering. I would say that since he was IFR, he could have insisted upon getting that. I don't think a controller, once you're IFR, can decline an instrument approach. My guess is that since this is in suburban Chicago, that it would have necessitated a lot of coordination with other air traffic to fit him in to fly the instrument approach. It was probably more convenient for the controller to vector him in at some closer in path that would keep him from flying a really long distance. I mean, we'd have to look at the instrument approach procedure for GPS 3-6, but my guess is it probably infringes on other airspace, which makes it difficult to use. So that's why I think he probably declined, but I'm sure the pilot could have insisted and gotten it. He said in a few minutes he called, said it was a mile directly in front of me. After much searching, I located it and canceled IFR. Now, by the way, if you don't see the runway until it's a mile away, good chance that you're end up being high and have to kind of maneuver to get down. He says, after much searching, I located it, canceled IFR, and as I was entering the pattern, I could hear ice being slung from the prop. That reaffirmed my earlier decision to request a lower altitude. The landing to the north was uneventful and a welcome relief for my passenger. Yeah, it's never fun carrying ice, and it's not fun listening to it come off the airplane and hitting the airplane as well, but it sounds like it all worked out well. These days, finding airports is a lot easier than it used to be just because of GPS, but even with the GPS, you still have to visually acquire the airport before you can cancel IFR and land visually.
So he wrote that he saw the ice with his flashlight.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a typical method for discovering, ice when you're flying at night?
I would say so, yeah, yeah? Because if it's forming on the wings, you might not be aware of it until you somehow lit up the wing and could actually see it forming. Often when it's forming on the wings, it'll be forming on the windshield, and so you might see that as well, too. But, yeah, I would say that's not an uncommon way to detect ice.
I actually mentioned that to John, and he wrote back, and he said, let's see if I remember this correctly, that he keeps a flashlight with him. He might even have it on a lanyard around his neck, but that way he's got it always available for a situation like this.
Yeah, I have a small flashlight on a lanyard, and I just like it because I can always get to it instantly. I always know exactly where it is. Now, some aircraft will have ice lights built into them, so all the late model Cirrus SR-22s have lights that you can turn on, and they light up both wings, and that makes it a lot easier to see if you're picking up ice.
Interesting. All right. Well, I thought that would be interesting, Max, for you to sort of, you know, interpret you know, some of the points here for the non-pilots in the group. Interesting, interesting stuff. And of course, ice is maybe, other than a fire on the plane, is one of your worst nightmares.
Well, for sure, you want to avoid it. And if it gets severe, then it can become a bad nightmare. But I was just going to ask you to kind of explain this concept of ice to me, because I'm out here in California, and
yeah, what's ice?
Oh, you oh.
No, I'm teasing. And we actually get ice here all the time in Northern California. Typically, it doesn't come all the way down to the surface, but it's not unusual to have ice as low as 3,000-4,000 feet above the ground. And that totally locks us in, because the minimum altitudes for leaving this area, IFR, are 5,000 feet. So if the freezing level is down below 5,000 feet, you're not going to get out of here unless you happen to be flying a very capable aircraft that has flight into known icing capability. Most GA aircraft don't have that. And when you've got ice low to the ground, you stay on the ground.
Yes.
You don't have pneumatic rubber leading edges like you do on a B-17 that you inflate to crack the ice so the airstream takes it off, like we did it in World War II.
Yeah, absolutely. But most of those are, you know, million-dollar aircraft. And as Tom was just relating, we have many aircraft in the fleet that are worth, you know, a fraction of that.
Yeah, that was an interesting statistic. So one last question for me, though. On ice being slung from the prop, so does that mean that ice was forming on the propeller and then subsequently was, you know, released from it? Is that what that means?
Yeah, definitely. So it sounds like the lower he went as he was about to land, the warmer it got, and that's when the ice started to come off. So, yes, ice is going to form on just about any kind of surface on the airplane. It starts on the small radius devices, so things that are thin like antennas are kind of the first places that pick up ice.
So one more question. Is ice on the propeller, is that anywhere near the same cause for concern as ice on a wing?
Well, the big deal on ice on the propeller would be if it is not applied in a consistent fashion. Imagine, you know, you've got ice on one blade and not on the other. Now you've got wildly unbalanced prop and you have a tremendous amount of vibration. So, yeah, ice on the prop, you kind of hope that it adheres in a somewhat uniform manner and comes off, you know, in a uniform manner. But, of course, I would say that, you know, that's not always the case.
So if I decide someday to learn to fly, I think I'm going to move to California, someplace close to you.
There you go. You're welcome out here. So then we're going to have to change things. You're no longer going to be, you know, Max East. You're going to become other Max, I think.
Then I'd be the other Max.
Exactly.
Okay. All right. Let's wrap this one up. Thanks for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. We really want to thank Tom Haynes, AOPA's Senior VP of Media Outreach and Communications, for joining us for this episode. Tom's a great guy and a real joy to talk with. You can find the AOPA course at aopa.org. You can find us at airplanegeeks.com. As always, we have show notes for this episode at airplanegeeks.com/536. Well, let's tell folks where they can find each of us online. And let's start with David Vanderhoof. David, where do folks find you?
Recently, almost every job board on the planet. So if anybody has any leads out there for jobs in the aviation or drone industries, let me know. You can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof. You can find me on our Slack listener team. And that is, you can join that club, that exclusive limited edition club, by sending us an email to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And Max and I, like the old speakeasy keepers, will send you a password to get in, commonly known as a hyperlink. And you can join the conversation. And last but not least, you can find me on Friday mornings talking about UASs and drones on the UAV Digest with Max Flight.
All right. And Max Trescott, how about you?
Well, David, I just heard of a job for helping to market for a podcast company, but it's in Phoenix, Arizona. But if you're interested, let me know. If anybody else is interested, let me know.
Sounds warm.
Hot. Yeah, well, that's true.
It's a hot job lead. Okay, I'll take it.
Sounds good. Let's see, aviationnewstalk.com. That's my website for the Aviation News Talk podcast. Just click on contact and you can send me an email if you are interested in any kind of flight training in the San Francisco Bay Area, or if you are thinking about buying a Cirrus of any kind, definitely call me. I've got all kinds of suggestions that I can make to help people who are looking to acquire airplanes or to learn to fly them.
Great. And that includes the jet, right?
The Cirrus Vision Jet. Yes, I'm looking forward to flying that again here next week, so it should be fun.
You are? Oh, that's great. Maybe I should come out and you can take me for a ride.
Well, we could do your flight training in that. It might take a little longer to get you to solo, but I'm sure it's possible.
Yeah, but longer is okay because that just extends the fun.
Exactly.
You can find me on LinkedIn. Just look for Max Flight. Also, as David said, at the UAVDigest.com, talking unmanned aviation. And also with Mary Kirby at PaxXPodcast.com, talking about the passenger experience. Our outro is by Bruno Missone. As always, you can visit BrunoMissone.com, learn more about his compositions. And please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Bye, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
Thank you for listening.
Ladies and gentlemen.